Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 18th, 2005. This session, Partners with the Poor, Values-Based Human Development, presented by Jerry Acker in the Creekside Room. Let's listen in.
About that period, and it intertwined some factual information into it. And there was about 2 million Vietnamese, that, North Vietnamese, that died from North Vietnamese army and civilians. We went as a newly graduated MSW Master of Social Work. And my wife was fairly new as a registered nurse, just green as we could be. We didn't know what we were getting into. And along with many others that the churches in this country decided to send, because we had to have a response to what was happening to the Vietnamese people. And so there were, over that 10-year period, lots of Mennonites who went there because they were conscientious objectors. The Mennonites and the Quakers and the Church of the Brethren are historical peace churches. And so Mennonite Central Committee, Lutheran World Relief, and Church World Service went together and formed a large organization, which we call Vietnam Christian Service. And I worked, my wife and I worked up in the highlands with in a very small village area with the Montagnard people for the first year we were there. And then we went to work, and I went to be the program director. That was very premature for me to take on such large responsibility, but I learned a tremendous amount. And then we went home for a year, and I worked in U.S. social work, and then we had itchy feet again, and we decided to put our names into the mission boards, the Lutheran Church in America and ALC, and we were called to go to Peru. When we went to Peru, there was a job description. The missionaries there were mostly pastors, and they said, we have this tremendous amount of poverty here, and just huge social problems, and we need a social worker. They didn't know what they wanted the social worker to do, but come and study the situation and make recommendations. Well, luckily I was saved from that by a huge earthquake that happened about a month after we got there. I went and worked in the northern Peru one Sunday afternoon in the course of about a few minutes. A huge earthquake killed about 60,000 people in northern Peru. One of the biggest earthquakes in the last century. And so again, the churches, Church World Service, and Lutheran World Relief, and our mission board went together and said, I can go and work in that area. So I did. And I worked for the better part of the year living in a tent in northern Peru. And then I got fascinated because I ran into people that have been doing what they call colonization work with poor people in Bolivia. People that were going down into the jungle in the Amazon basin and trying to hack out a new life in sort of virgin forest, just pushing back the jungle, cutting down trees, starting up, and then this sort of, what they called it, literally colonization. And so I went over there and made a visit, and I thought that would be interesting to try and prove too. So I made the recommendation, and my wife and I, and our kids, little toddlers at that time, moved over into the jungle on the other side in the Amazon basin of Peru, where we worked for a couple of years. After that, we were replaced by, we said we should be really replaced by an agronomist or somebody that knows agriculture. It was turning into be a lot of agriculture stuff. And I recommended that, and the mission board replaced me. One of the problems, and this is part of the learning, is that when they replaced me, that person didn't have the same appreciation for what I had started, as I thought it should have been continuity. So he started something completely different. In fact, he had the theory, because he was kind of arrogant, I thought. He had worked at the Peace Corps someplace. And he came down there and he said, we really should go and live with the people. So they had a little baby. And he and his wife and his little baby, and his wife was very naive. She didn't know what she was getting into, but he was sort of the leader. They went and they literally moved into the shelter that we had built for our pig project. They moved into the pig house out there where the people were. And to make a long story short, on that part, that sort of represents one of the problems in development work of continuity. If you start something, how do you start something that has and will have a chance to continue and will, you know, be grabbed a hold of by the local people and so forth? Well, we went home and we were, by the way, I wanted to say that we were privileged to work with Abner and Martha Batelden, who are Paul's parents, in Vietnam. And they had been in Korea before.
And they
knew. Huh?
And they knew.
And I guess Abner is now, Bat, we call him, is 97?
He'll be 97.
Years old. Mm. Wonderful person. And there's three generations of Batelden's here in the village right now. Chris is one of them. Well, Chris and Sonia. I give you that background because after we got home, we were home for about a month, and we were discerning, we were praying for our future. We were driving down the street in Minneapolis. We were on a furlough for, we're going to be home for a few months. Driving down the street, I remember very distinctly hearing the report that there was a major earthquake in Managua, Nicaragua, 2 days before Christmas, 1972. And my wife and I looked at each other and we said, okay, that's where we're going. Part of discernment and part of vocation in working with the poor and working with the church has to do with sort of openness to be the right person in the right place at the right time. These things sometimes just come together. And if you're open to that, I think those opportunities do present themselves. And so I didn't have, what I'm saying this by way of saying that I had, did not have a well-planned out career. I didn't know what I was getting into when I started. I was going to work in social work. And in those years, 40 years ago, there was no place to study this, development, international development, international management. Now there's many graduate schools in the United States. You can go to Vermont, Brattleboro, where they have the School for International Training. There's all kinds of places where this is, you know, studied as a professional area. When I started, I could find two books probably on community development or something like that. So I say that as a way of saying that this kind of career or this kind of work with the poor and with critical situations in poverty takes a lot of learning. And I think those first 5 years were a time of learning. And when I got to Nicaragua, it started coming together. And I followed two or three principles. In fact, I told them in New York before I went, I'll go there and do the coordinating for the church's response to the Managua earthquake if I'll follow these principles. I'm going to start working with the local churches from the beginning. It's going to be their program. Secondly, I want to have authority over, or veto power maybe, over who else you send. I want good people. I had some bad experiences with volunteers that had been sent to Peru. And we had some semi-disasters in terms of personnel that came to Vietnam into difficult situations. You have to select the right people. And, you know, I said, and also we're going to build a long-term program. We're not just going to respond to a disaster. And that's what we started doing right from the beginning. The first meetings of this organization, of the churches that we put together were, you know, all the buildings were destroyed. We met under the trees in the schoolyard of the Baptist school. And so that was kind of the principle of starting working with people. And I think that my role evolved, and I'm very, very pleased with the way it worked, that I could work with others. And I wasn't trying to do it myself. Oftentimes we think that if you go overseas as a missionary or whatever, and the Peace Corps still does this, but we work right directly with the poor, right at the grassroots, right with the people. And we need to know those people. We need to be in touch with them and work with them. We need to understand their values and their stories, but we also need to lift up, train, work with, advise the local people to be able to do that job. And that's been my philosophy ever since. I think it's proven that it's because CEPAD, the church organization that we started, became one of the major forces for really helping Nicaraguan poor people through many years of turmoil, not only the earthquake, but then the Somoza time, the Sandinista revolution, the counter-revolution. They've had droughts, disasters, volcanoes, earthquakes, floods, everything. But the organization and this program of church people have been able, in Nicaragua, have been able to stay with those people throughout this whole time. I went, after about 5-6 years in Nicaragua, I went to work with Heifer Project International, which is an organization that the niche is working with livestock to help poor rural families, mostly at that time, which now have urban agriculture projects. And I worked for a number of years and then left and went back to Latin America and was with Lutheran World Relief again. But in the 90s, I came back and had the privilege of being the director of training for Heifer Project International, which was a worldwide responsibility. And that's where I wanted to kind of map out what we articulated in the model that we developed for working with people to help them define their own vision and their values so that they can, the development can be their own. In, first of all, there's, I think that the philosopher's question was what to do with wholeness or something like that. Anybody remember a question at breakfast? Anyway, it struck a bell because we work with a holistic approach when we think about human development, community development. And the holistic approach comes, it has its roots and antecedents too in social science and I think in science. But what are the four or five things, components, when you think of holism? Are you familiar with that term? What would?
Physical means.
Yeah, physical.
Mental. Emotional.
Spiritual.
Yeah, mental, spiritual, and emotional. But we actually add another one, which is probably incorporated in, but we add ecological. And it would seem, and then out of, this is very commonly thought of in the field that I'm talking about by many NGOs. NGOs are non-government organizations that work in around the world with in many different ways. But if you're working in development of people, development of organizations, and so forth, we typically talk about a holistic approach. However, in many programs, there tends to be a focus on one area or another. And this physical material, which probably also includes the economic, that tends to be the focus of a lot of programs. You know? And but also there's many programs having to do with education. And now there's, in the last 10 years, 15 years, many ecological and environmental programs to save the planet, to save national parks, to save the forests and so forth, to conserve. Some programs are there. There tends to be a predominance of one over the other. But my experience, this spiritual part, people really shy away from. And there's a reason for that, because there's almost a gut reaction against the image, the legacy of, say, for instance, missionary work. And missionaries have sort of a bad name, not in my mind. I think missionaries had a tremendous amount before those came in later in development work. They established hospitals, they established schools, they established agricultural work and so forth. And maybe there were a lot of paternalism, but I've seen also a lot of good long-lasting effects of that. So we struggled in Heifer Project with what does it mean to incorporate that, the spiritual aspect. Because we're not only working with Christians, in our, either in staff or the people that we aim to work with. So it is a hard thing for people to define what is spirituality. But people sort of know it when they see it, or they know it when they experience it, but they don't, it's hard to define. And most people would say, well, it's not religion, not a specific religion. But it was interesting, a few years ago, the World Bank itself called a big conference on the spirituality component in development in programs. And that was very rare. But at recognizing, and many academics and others will recognize that there is a spiritual component in people. But I don't know, your experience, Paul, do you feel that in the professions and in academia, there is a kind of a struggle with probably wanting to ignore that part?
It has to be a different language that enables the conversation than the word spirit. Like opening the topic of sort of the whole person showing up for work is a way of enabling the conversation around that. But sort of talking about the spiritual dimensions of professional work sort of shuts doors down, I think so.
And in academia, there's this sort of fear of stepping on somebody's toes, I think. So you kind of tread a little carefully if you're talking about spiritual things, if you're in a public or non-church-related
institution. Yeah.
I think Parker Palmer has helped with that in teaching, in the teacher development work that he's done, where he's been able to connect the inner life of the teacher and the sort of the challenge of continuing to invite the whole person who is the teacher to show up for work, and the relationship between that failure and the phenomenon of burnout, and the other kinds of challenges that we face, and basically tired or early checking out people from meaningful work. And
I like that term, show up for work.
Mm-hmm. And so we've been working on that.
The whole person show up for work. Yeah.
It opens a different conversation.
Yeah, it does. And that's when I really started trying to figure out, in the early 90s, as I said, I went back to the Heifer Project, and the first thing they asked me to do was to write out what is our philosophy of development, and then to write another book, which was, what is our model of working with people. And we had developed a list of, there were 10 principles, that we called cornerstones. And so the first book became known as the Cornerstone Model. We changed that now because we realized that the cornerstones that we set, for instance, one of them is participation. Another is what we call passing on the gift, which is a kind of a key principle in Heifer Project. All of these principles were, we asked the question, okay, what would you have to have together in a project if it was going to be, if we were going to define success, what were the component parts that we would have to consider, we should consider? For instance, gender and family was another one of them. And the last one that we added was spirituality. And that came after kind of a not being comfortable with it for a while. Even in an organization that started as a Christian, out of Christian roots and as a Christian organization, many organizations like that start, colleges included, and they turn out to be secular, but they have this sort of spirituality underneath or in their roots. But they don't know how to talk about it in work terms or in our philosophy of work or our model of work. So we struggled with that. It was easier to define what we meant by passing on the hip. Very, very easy to define that, or gender, and so forth. Well, there's resistance to gender, but at least we could easily discuss it. Because you got men and women in the room, where you can just throw out an open question and get it going. But we started, also, of course, we had people who were not only Christians, they weren't Christians, they were, I think of I wouldn't know if that's a religion, but it's sort of the new age, environmental, very bright young people that are coming out of the universities that are very motivated to work for a better world, but they don't find themselves as Christians. And then we would have some Jewish people on staff, and we would have of course, in Asia, we would have many Buddhists and some more Hindus. We can still talk about spirituality. But how can we talk about it? Are we comfortable talking about it? Can we still mention Christ in our meetings? Should we open with prayer? All these kind of things kind of give people a little, you know, stuff inside to deal with. If you're working in a secular institution, you have to deal with that, right?
Yeah. Well, it's harder to deal with it. I mean, because you feel like it's, spirituality is so often defined as a religion. And so you get into the issues of church and state that immediately come to the fore.
Yeah.
And you know, most of my colleagues have nothing to do with religion. And so they just find this to be an unnecessary part of
it. Yvonne is a professor and a biologist.
Mm-hmm. Natural Science Department.
What university?
Colby Sawyer College. It's a small
college.
Secular liberal arts school.
Spirituality, when we, you know, I want to show you an eraser. This is an eraser. I want to show you the model that I came up with. Of course, it's not only my model, but I had the job of trying to articulate.
Oh, what happened? Bird
right in the window.
Oh, maybe it'll come to you.
Yeah.
This model, which I finally came up with on a graph, and people and wrote it out in many workshops around the world, which we call the cornerstone model, and then we've changed it over 10-year periods. I'm writing a new book, which now we're calling Values-Based Development. That when you start with a community or any situation you go into, four communities, four countries, whatever, or an organization, you start with some kind of a situation, and I realized that we needed to stay away from the sort of classical or traditional words like diagnosis. Or the felt needs. This is an early theory in working with poor communities, what's called the felt needs theory. You go to people and ask them what they need. What's your problem? And you know, you make a whole long list of problems, then you prioritize those problems, and now let's start working on these top three. Okay. What might you think would be wrong with that approach? Or write about it? Starting with problems.
You give the assumption that all they have are problems and no resources.
It doesn't give you any insight into the strengths.
That's right. Mm. That's the main thing there.
And there's a power dynamic, too.
Pardon?
There can be a power dynamic,
sure.
Too.
Sure. Yeah. And so, we don't call it, in fact, still I hear most NGOs, most organizations that work with poor communities, which we call NGOs, church-related or not, use the term. In Latin America, we do a diagnostico, we do a diagnosis. Where does diagnosis come out of? What model does that come out of?
Yes.
The medical. What does the doctor do? You know what the doctor does, Paul. You find what the illness of the patient, and you give a recipe, or not a recipe, a
prescription.
And pill. Solve the problem. I don't know, that's real simplistic, but that comes out of it. So, the way that the felt needs theory did was to go rapidly. What we decided to call this was define the situation. And in that, we looked at three parts. I'm trying to keep it so simple that people could memorize this. And so people, place, and then to find another P, production or productive resources. Okay, everything, human resources, natural resources, money, everything that they had going for them. We don't assume that people are starting with nothing. Now there is that whole thing about working with the poorest of the poor. Do you think that some people don't have anything to start with? You think there are people at that level? And where would they be in this paradigm?
Possibly people in the disaster type situation,
right,
where
yeah.
they're really...
This is not applied to a disaster situation necessarily, but it could be something you build on out of a disaster situation. People are just, they lost everything. So you start with relief, response, emergencies, and that kind of thing. But in order to understand the people and the place, and place when you're working with the organization, it can be also organization or physical place. It can be the community itself, or it can be the organization. It can be the geographical or the organization. And the productive resources, how do we get that? How would you find out about these people? What would you do to find out?
Got to inquire.
You got to inquire? You got any ideas about how to do that? To make this inquiry?
We could ask what they're proud of, what
right.
that gives them a sense of vitality, what gives them a sense of threat to their life, what kinds of things are. Source of joy, pride.
Yeah. You start basically with their story by asking positive questions. And by the way, you can use this theory and this model when you work with your church, when you work with any organization in any place. And this, we drew a lot from a body of knowledge and research and practice that's called AI. And that doesn't mean artificial insemination. It means appreciative inquiry. And there's a lot, and I'm not an expert on that, but I think Paul has got more knowledge of that than I do. But those kind of questions are asked to start. And then, in any, what if there's anything that we've learned in the last 40 years about how to work, about what we need to do in order to work with people, we need to follow the principle of participation. And so this doesn't start as if it's a moment in time that you're just starting now. It has a background. It has a story. And so we look for ways that we can help people tell their story. I wrote down some terms here that were kind of a progression of methodology for doing surveys and making inquiry. One of the first one was called rapid rural appraisal. And what they did then was to put together an interdisciplinary team of experts. You would have an agronomist, you'd have a social scientist, you might have a health person. And they would go in and rapidly assess the situation and document it. And you can do that by walking through, you can talk to people, interviews, and all that kind of thing. But it's not participatory necessarily. It could be participatory, but they realize that this is also following this sort of diagnosis model. So then they moved to participatory rural appraisal, and they tried to get more participation from the community. And finally, I think the last term was participatory learning and action. Okay, well that gets to the idea that we can actually learn something and everybody together can learn something and then we move to action. So those are sort of theories and practices that I looked at and knew something about. And then also I looked at holistic resource management. Anybody ever heard of that? It developed out of Africa. Man by the name of Alan Savory. And that was particularly interested in that because he looked at large game parks and ranches, resources, and how to manage that in a holistic way. And he came up with a model too, which is a little bit more complicated than this, but some of this is based upon his early work.
What was his name, Jim?
Alan Savory. Fascinating man. He was a Rhodesian, but he was pretty well accepted by the Zimbabwe government. You know, he was a white, of course, and he was from that country. He developed this and became quite famous. And came to the United States and he's taught this in a lot of places, particularly in sustainable agriculture movements in the United States and that kind of thing. He's also one of the most self-assured people I've ever run into that he has the answer. I mean, he would make a presentation and he said, you don't have to worry anymore. We found the answer. We found the model that works. So, but I learned something from him, but this is not, this, I think this is an easier model for people to work with. When I was rewriting this book, and I'm doing this by a lot of email, and I'm in touch with people all over the world by email, and I asked them, you know, what do you need in order to give you good guidance and help? Well, it's got to be simple. These are people that are working directly with communities. They're field people. They're maybe an agronomist or what we call a promoter, working directly with field people out there in Ghana or Zimbabwe or Bolivia. So, story, and I'm going to give you an example about a technique for doing participatory storytelling. And you can learn a lot. And this is called group tell. And since we don't all have the same story, I'll pick a story that we all know. I think most of us know. And it's the story of a man that had two sons. What story is that?
Loving father. And,
yeah. Okay, so here's the way this works. So somebody starts it, and then the first person doesn't tell the whole story because somebody else picks it up. Somebody else heard about the story. And if you're in a group or a community, the one that has the longest history will start the story. And then other people have entered an organization later or the group, they can pick it up when they came into the story. But since we don't have that situation, we'll just sort of demonstrate it here. And the way you get into the story is to say, I'll start it. And then but in storytelling, we often have this thing about, yeah, but before that. So you go back and forth a little bit, but you keep going forward until you told the story. But someone also will think about what was happening in the bigger context behind that. So then we have another entry point, which is, meanwhile, back in the ranch. So let's start it. I'm going to start it. And anybody can enter in and we'll tell it till we've told the story. There was a man that had two sons. And then
one of his sons came to him and said, "Father, I don't know what I want you to give me my share of whatever you think is mine in the family." And then
what happened?
And so the father responded and gave him what was his share. The son was an adventurous sort. He wanted to go find his own place in the world. And he had a lot of gifts, probably, that he wanted to see if he could use in his spiritual life. And then
the other son realized that the local action was his. And so he went to work and planned just how he would continue the legacy that he was going to get from his dad, which was now pretty clear to him because the other son was out of the way and had been paid off. And so the local son, the remaining son, developed a sense of the place and a sense of himself and a sense of the way the world would be in the future. And basically had things pretty well together. And then
meanwhile, the other son was squandering his fortune. Losing it and gambling and leading out the healthiest lifestyle.
Mm. Where'd he go?
It's a good question.
He went to a far country.
Far, far away. Away from his homeland.
And then, remember what happened?
Well, then he decided to go home because he wasn't having a good life after all. So back he goes, and I'm sure he doesn't know what he's going to find, and then...
but before that, he said, "I'm going to go back because just to ask for a job with my father's house, because I don't have anything, and it'd be better than eating here with the pigs.
We went back home, and the call is, that's what the brotherhood said, you didn't think that the father was. The father greeted him with open arms, and the other brother was very upset about it, so we called.
The father threw a big feast in honor of his return? That's right. Which upset the other son that had been working hard and making his way, didn't quite understand the warm welcome that the father gave to the other son.
And the father forgot to go out in the field and tell the brother that the other brother was home, so he just heard about the party.
Yeah.
And then?
And the way I remember it, the old man went running when he saw his son coming over the horizon. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also remember that the son, the first son, maybe even more than just realizing things weren't going so well, really crashed. I mean, was not even just a matter of, well, this is a once in a long moment. It was he bottomed out. He hit bottom.
And what
it was really bad. And then he came to himself.
Okay.
In other words, it was as though he wasn't really himself. But he had an awakening or a conversion.
And do you remember what he said to himself?
He said, I'll go back to my father and ask for forgiveness.
And so how did it all end out? What happened? How did this come out?
The brother said, here I've worked for you all these years, and you've never even given me anything that I could have parties with my friends. And here's this son who hasn't done anything that you would want him to do, and he comes back and you've given him a new robe and rings and parties and and what am I to think?
Is that the end of the story? Is that where we're at? Sort of?
Well, the father did answer.
Oh, yeah.
And he said I felt comfortable that you were with me and that you were safe and I wasn't worried about you. And you can have anything you want. This guy was worried about it because he was lost.
Came back. We all had pretty much the same take on that story. Because we've heard it, it's very, very familiar. If we were telling a story and we were in the same group or community, and we said, well, let's, you know, even in your church, if you're saying, okay, let's review, let's tell the story of what's happened in our evangelism program in the church or whatever. People have participated in this. They can all get in and they might have slightly different perspectives on what's happened, but they tell the story together and you hear these different perspectives. The kind of the tricky part is if somebody comes up with something that seems to be off base, didn't happen in some according to another person, do you interrupt that person or just let them tell the story? You know, what would you do?
I think it's important to seek clarification because at that point you have an opportunity to learn something more than what the labels are that have been talked about.
Right.
And oftentimes the clarification, asking someone to say more about that or seeking insight into how could that be true and that was true or can you help me understand how, but not allowing that apparent conflict to go unexplored, because that conflict offers a gift of further or deeper level of understanding.
Yeah, and I think that's a role of a facilitator that's sensitive to that. What happens often if you go into a community, a poor community, any place, and ask people to tell their story, you know, tell us your story about this project that we're, you know, this typically happens in visits from North American mission groups. They go in, and this is a project, this is a community we've been working with. We want to them to tell your story. And what happens often, it's not done in a participatory way. I've been, you know, in many situations in which a man will stand up, first of all, the leader, and a spokesperson who has confidence and will tell the story. And people, you know, if they're not trained in the participatory, not used to participation, they won't interrupt, they won't correct, and that kind of thing. You might have in the back of their mind different perceptions, but they'll allow the leader to tell the story. I can remember in Aymara village. Aymara is a large indigenous group in the highlands of Bolivia, where Amy's father is. You see Aymara?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, the women came in and they sat on the ground, and it's a dirt floor building anyway. You got these big hoop skirts and they come in. These hats, and they sit down and sit on the floor. And the men are sitting on the few chairs that there are, or the benches in the schoolhouse or whatever it is. And so we go try to get into, okay, tell us about what's happened in this community. A man gets up and starts talking, and they will go on for some time, and, you know, if there's no facilitation. And so then I ask, I see there's a number of women here. Could one of the women tell us from their perspective what's, you know, their story? And they sit there in silence. Of course, it's very embarrassing for them if they're not, you know, there's foreigners in their midst and so forth. This would be in a place where the women hadn't been sort of empowered, or felt empowered to do that. And I remember very distinctly, well, I can speak for the women. Anyway, the story is very important. And in that story, we start hearing things, not only the story, the facts. And you can have documentation as you go along and take it down. You need to verify and get more information than just that story. But you start hearing about their values. You start hearing about these things like Paul mentioned. What a good question we ask is, what gives life and energy? What is it that you're proud of? What have you achieved together? And they start thinking about that. Instead of saying, okay, now what are your problems in this community? And you can make a long list of those. Because then they start thinking, oh, these people are here to solve our problems and give us things. No, we want to start with their story and say, what gives you life and energy and vitality? What are you proud of? So that they start feeling empowered. We have something. Who is here? What kind of human resources do you have here? Do you have any people who are teachers? Do you have any, what education do you already have? And that kind of thing. So you have these human resources. What physical resources do you have? So you start the planning with what they have, not with what we're going to bring in from the outside. And in this, we start hearing their values. We start hearing their values here, and then this is the vision of block box over here. This is defining the situation. And vision over here. And we try to help people draw a picture, literally draw pictures of sometimes, or descriptions of what do they visualize their quality of life would be if it was like they would want it to be in the future. So it's an image of their desired future. And we try to write in there some of the means that they might think about to get there. What will they be doing in being? What will they do and be 5 years from now? What is your vision? This is the vision part. And so rather than to go to problems and needs, which brings us, which cuts out this, and cuts out this, and we can go directly to there. This is where we do specific planning. There's where we say, okay, we've done all this, and by the way, on the way, these priorities start showing up, and then we plan with them. They plan for themselves what they want to do. And then this is where the specific plan starts shaping form, taking shape. And this part is pretty much like you do in normal planning. You know, you need to have good objectives, you need to have resources and budget, you need to have strategies and so forth. And this one would be monitoring and evaluation, and management really. And management is how you make decisions as you go along and monitor. Well, when it comes to monitoring or saying, oh, what have we achieved? What has been most important in this whole process? Well, we might have achieved some real concrete things. They might have a better life. They might have more income. They might have better food. We can measure that. But how would you measure if they're staying on track with their values? That's real. To me, that's a big thing, is that it's very popular for an organization to go through strategic planning and define core values and vision. But how do you live it? How do you help an organization or group actually live their values? I'll throw that question out to you. Any organization. Holden Village, a school, your church.
Leading by example.
Pardon?
Leading by example.
Okay.
I think that if you're going to teach something and have someone learn from it and grow from it, they need something. They've never done it before or know how to practice their values, and they need to have a physical example of it. Like you need to be leading. If you're going to teach a community to do something, you need to show them and say, like, this is how you do it. Or I think that they can't appreciate or know how to appreciate their values. They are not seeing someone else appreciate their values also.
Well, remember, though, that these are the values that they've defined.
Right. You know, but
so they come out of their experience.
Right. But do you find yourself following their examples and trying to live? I mean, you're trying to help the community.
Yeah.
Don't you need somehow, like you said, participation in the community?
Well, values? Leadership is certainly very important that they live the values. The leaders in the community, as well as the helping people, they have to live these values. That's what you're saying, right? That has to be incorporated not only by the mass of people, but
to make sure the values are known, that
right.
They can articulate. Like if we were all part of the same community, let's say a church or organization, that we could all say what the values are, to teach them the values, to have them written in places that they can be reminded of them. Would be very important.
This is a critical thing that we're talking about, because remember that we've worked with them through a series of things, and we've come up with a list of, and I usually try to ask them to pare it down to some three or four things, values that they can remember by heart. They know by heart. The people that have gone through this process are not the only people that are going to be living these values, but they might not have been in the community. I mean, they might not have been in the meetings. So how are they going to incorporate the values? Now, we're using the word teaching them. Do we just tell them? How do you teach values? Gross example, leading by example, Enron. What was one of their core values?
Make money.
No, it was integrity. Their core value was integrity. Explicit, put down in their statement, their vision statement or their value statement. So that to me is the biggest problem we have in organizations, in our country, and in implementing something like this is, how do you actually live our values as a society, as a group, as a community?
I think you get to the behaviors and actions or examples that really, that in some way embody what you're labeling as a value, and so that people have an understanding of what the value means in daily life.
Yeah.
And why that's a good label for that behavior.
In a way, here's a technique that, I learned from Bolivians about this one. Bolivians, the program in Bolivia, they just took off with this in the poor community, in these colonization areas in Bolivia. A whole program, every community has defined their values and their vision. That's the first thing they define.
And they all know it.
And they know it, and they work with it. I mean, there's a Bolivian woman, I mean, a very specific example, it was a poor community, and this woman says at the next meeting, you know, they define these values, you know, months later. We have to evaluate, how are we doing with these? We have to recheck. We have to come back to them, continually come back to them. So what we do is, let's just think together, what would be a core value that you experienced here at Holden? Because this is a community. Just think of one in your mind, just spit it out. And
respect.
Respect? Everyone agree with that, or do you have another one?
I was going to say acceptance, but I guess that's kind of implied in respect.
Acceptance. I like that one. There's many values that we experience here. Mm-hmm. Okay, say that the board and the core staff here, the long-term staff, had gone through an exercise and they said, well, we define our core values as these five. You know what's happening in this community every week? New people are coming in, constantly coming in. New staff, new volunteers. How do they even know about these? How do they incorporate them?
Not that they don't have them, but to let it be known.
Let it be known
by the leader. And that's, for me, that's right. There's a ways of learning.
So communication.
Having it up. I recommend in the poorest community, I say, if you've gone through this exercise, don't just leave it on the flip chart. We work with flip charts. We don't work with PowerPoint. And put it up there, and you can write these things in the meeting hall. Every time they walk into the meeting, they see that. And I recommend, okay, every month, let's take one of these. I say, how are we doing? You know, have some kind of a little exercise with that. And there's real simple ways to monitor and evaluate. But Paul mentioned something very important, is define it. And so if we use acceptance or respect, this is what I help people do. I say, we show, or let's say we are respectful when, and they have to fill out behaviors, very specific behaviors. We are respectful when. And people can do that, and it becomes part of what we decide together. Mm-hmm. And it gets down to, you know, acceptance, and you can do that with any core value. But that's, to me, that's the crux of the matter, is when you get to the using a system that works with values and vision, it has to be incorporated so that we all. And the same, I bet you it's the same thing at a church. You got new people coming in.
Yeah,
I'm
just thinking about this in terms of a visioning process in a congregation or something. I mean, it's applicable.
Are there also stories that need to be a part of that? Because I'm sure when people come up with these values and all in the beginning, they must have some traditional stories that also demonstrate those that are.
Right.
They're part of the community that are passed on.
Those values are important because they come out of their culture.
Mm-hmm.
They come out of their stories.
Mm-hmm.
And what the outside helping agency can do is to document some of those stories, and they can, you know, it's kind of putting them down and helping them retell the stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that. Isn't that clear?
There.
I think it's so much fun. And I'll tell you another thing is that it takes experience with it. I wrote this book in 1995, and then if you've ever had an experience of writing a book, and it comes out, and you're all excited about it, and it arrived in the organization like a non-event, you know, nobody noticed it. So I started doing workshops all over the world. I had a grant to do that, and so I went to Asia, and I did a 3-day workshop, introduction of this model, and I've done many of them all over the world. And but that was the first one in Indonesia. We had the staff from about 8 different countries. And they went through this and they applied it to themselves, their own home offices, you know, their own home organizations in each country. And then at the end of the workshop, I said, okay, what are you going to do with this now? They were turned on. They were, oh, I'm going to go home and I'm going to translate this into my own language. So it's translated into Indonesian, into Thai, and the Nepalese, and Chinese. But they had to experience it. It didn't mean anything, you know, until they personally experienced it. And so that's part of this what you're talking about, retelling the story too, is if you don't, a group going through this and coming up with this, sometimes if you, as an outsider, read their vision statement, you say, well, okay. But if they've done it themselves, the process is as important as the product, you know, the vision statement itself. So you have to rework it with people. Is it, what time is it time to quit?
44.
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any last question or questions or comments? And Paul should have given this class because he's had a lot of experience with values.
I'm curious how you deal with the inexorables that surround the local kind of initiative, because there is, this helps the group or organization or community, but then there's a series of inexorables that have to do with the aging of the population, or that have to do with the growth of demands on water, or any of a variety of what might be described as things that are just going to happen, whether this group does anything about it or not. They're sort of in process, and these are these mega things that are going to, in some way, impact whatever it is they're coming up with. And they're going to, whatever they work on is going to be contextualized in part by these inexorables. That
you mentioned monitoring and evaluation.
Yeah.
And then we revisit the people, the place, and the productive resources. Where are you now? A year later, the people have changed. There's new people that have come in. People have been added to the community. Some new leadership has developed. Another thing that we do is that we bring them through this far, and then we have, okay, you've got your vision, and then we do what we call, you know, force field analysis.
Right.
You say, okay, this is where you want to go, and this is what's pushing you, your values. And this is your vision. What are those forces going against us? And they can define those very easily. What are those things, those things that are pushing against it, I guess, on this side?
Yeah.
And what is pushing you forward? What do you got going for you? But there's going to be some counter forces over there, inextricables or whatever. And some of those are external. Some of our internal, they can work mostly on the internal ones.
And that's something to do some ways into it? Like
In the planning process we do this.
Or in the planning. Yeah. To start off identifying
this process might take some time, and you can enter it at any point. But if you're working on vision, the classical way in strategic planning is use the SWOT analysis, you know, which is you start out with strengths, weaknesses, threats, and opportunities. And that's of the present situation. What we do is to do the sort of force field analysis on the vision. What are those things you've got going for you, and what are pushing against you?
And that force field analysis has been very helpful for me. The Kurt Lewins, the guy who described that, and one of the things that he described that I think we often forget is to diminish the potency of the restraining forces as the point of first departure. we oftentimes tend to strengthen the promoting forces rather than diminishing the potency of the restraining forces. And I think that the diminishment of the restraining forces is an unlearning. And I think we're geared to learn, but not geared to unlearn. And so part of the real challenge is to learn to unlearn, because it's the unlearning of the way we've usually done stuff that usually allows new things to become possible.
That's a very good point. Well, I tried to put some theory and practice in here, and
that's great.
It wasn't a bit too confusing, but it's part of my story, so.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I always want to ask.
The other problem that we often have where I am in doing this is that we're so concerned about having things that you can measure for your outcomes that these things really are important and of value. Well, we can't really put that in because there isn't a way to measure it.
Right. It's not quantifiable.
It's not quantifiable. Yeah, how are we going to measure that?
Yeah.
And I think all of us can see that there aren't really ways that you can measure some of those things that aren't all that quantitative.
Yeah.
And if you limit yourself to what you can measure really quantitatively, you really have limited what you can hope to do, because so much of education is not necessarily so quantifiable.
Right.
And so we have to think about being able to measure those things in ways that are different from the traditional, whether it's test scores or you know, the number of people going out of graduate school or, you know.
Well, and our challenge, my challenge.
I really like this model.
Is to make it as simple as possible, but also make it somewhat comprehensive.
Not too complex. It's got to be robust.
But what we do with that, and which we call participatory project and replanning, and we would take a group of people that have been working together in a project for a year or two or whatever, and you do have the objectives of that project written down, and they're probably related to income or nutrition or something. But we would start with remembering what were the values. So, very unscientific, but it's very useful. We just, in a meeting of, and these are with illiterate people sometimes, we might use icons that show, okay, sharing is one of our values.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So you can get an icon that shows sharing, or they know that word, the leaders at least, they do. This word, and you put these different values there with icons. Then we did start out with a longer scale of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but we even simplified it down to 1, 2, 3, and we use icons for that sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting though, we started with the icon of the smiling face, the neutral face, and the sad face, and we even ran into a problem with that, because they were thinking, well, sad face would mean that you're not happy with us. We're not happy with this. Or we're not happy with what we were trying to do is say, how are you doing with sharing? And so right in the workshop, we would say, okay, let's remember how we define, because there's new people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Let's redefine sharing. What does it mean here? Okay, then they talk about that, and then write it down, or we just verbalize it. And then with very sort of basic voting, and for most cultures, very important, they do this anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a theme. So they get each to put a vote in, and you know, you just vote it up, and you see that one is the sad face, actually. So we ended up using a plant. Just there's a seed there. There's a little plant coming up here, and there's more of a tree there. And so then if you have, you know, the numbers here, then that's the ones you celebrate. Oh wow, we're doing well, and they can celebrate stories of sharing, and we're doing well in that. Now, over here, income generation was an objective, or food security maybe was a. Oh man, we just aren't doing very much there. Then that's where you start working again, replanning and so on. And that's been We're starting to use that a lot in, mm-hmm. in Heifer Project. I'm trying to introduce it in Agro's. But
how do you, I do like what you're doing. How do you take the one of the challenges that I think is really common as well is the inability of most planning models to deal with disconfirming data. Mm. So that what you have is a constructivist bias in what you're trying to construct. And so the challenge comes in being open to the potentially disconfirming evidence that emerges so that mm-hmm. you can incorporate that into the redesign of what you're doing. And so, and that might come in the form of a surprise or
yeah.
something that didn't happen. It strikes me that there's an opportunity in this model to sort of invite conversation about what surprised us.
Yeah.
Set up to do this and yeah. didn't really work. And then the question is, well, why did that surprise us? Mm-hmm. What
happened that we didn't expect?
Into a series of conversations around what the expectancy theory really was.
Yeah.
That was in.
What happens in my experience is there's time constraints. And so mm-hmm. in different cultures,
yeah.
to do this, in the U.S. projects,
yeah.
even with poor communities in the South or wherever they are,
yeah.
if you can get people together for 2-3 hours, you're doing well.
Well, they got a lot to do. I mean,
yeah,
to do.
Right.
So it can't be good at planning.
But they're, you know, they're much more impatient. And in Bolivia,
yeah.
they're used to sitting down and in a consensus model, and they'll meet until they're through.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll go on hours. You know? Mm-hmm. And so sometimes we almost abuse their time because we know that they'll sit there all day long working on this. You know? But then you can enter with those conversations and questions, which take time. You know?
That's great.
Yeah. Well, thank you for.
And Bat will be very happy to hear about what you're doing.
Well, yeah, that's great. I sent a
yeah.
letter for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, lunch.
Mm-hmm. Lunchtime.
I think it's a fair word.
Yes, I think it is.